You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Find out where The Takeaway is playing in your area by going to thetakeaway.org/stations.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and thanks so much for listening or calling.
Hello, everyone. I'm from your telephone company. And the message that we have for you is that we are changing your telephone service over to dial.
Wow, the age of dial telephones. That'll be great when we can just dial a phone call. Think how easy life will be then.
You may have noticed that lots of work has been going on. This is an investment in the future of your community.
In a moment, how the old telephone company of the 19th and 20th centuries is like and not alike the tech giants of today. The telephone monopoly was spectacularly reliable, but its overwhelming power made everyone a little nervous. Are the tech giants of today just friendly competitors with an enlightened sense of customer service, or are they the same scary communications monoliths of old? Also, technology and trust in a few other dimensions. Will commercial pilots trust the remote-controlled drones they will soon be sharing the airspace with? Can safety standards allow us to trust the viability of nuclear power in the United States? And what happens when the first language you learn is a programming language? That's a possible reality for a generation just around the corner. But first, this is worth remembering. We take you back to 1984.
AT&T is no newcomer to computers. Although AT&T previously was barred from selling computers in the open marketplace, its research and development arm, AT&T Bell Laboratories, has always been at the leading edge of computer technology.
Bell Labs, working with a few folks in the U.S. government. The development of the entire electronic computer industry was a government venture from the beginning, working with the telephone monopoly of the time. It was all bound up in the needs of the Defense Department for accurate calculation of bomb sighting, missile and artillery firing during World War II, and the needs of mass communication switching networks to accurately route calls. So when the National Security Agency compels tech companies to hand over their data, as we learned in the dramatic Snowden revelations last year, that happens routinely. The NSA is just doing what the government has done since the dawn of modern telephony. It's the Googles and Facebooks of the world, perhaps, who have had to adjust to this new old reality. And it's been a tough few years. Stephen Levy's new piece for Wired is called How the NSA Almost Killed the Internet. And he joins us now. Stephen Levy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Always a pleasure, John.
So what's going on here? Are Google and the companies that you spoke with for your piece naive or heroic in their response to the government's attempts to basically control the flow of information?
Well, they're neither. I mean, like AT&T, they're public companies, they're profit-making companies. They profess to be a little more idealistic. I think maybe you can make a case for that. But ultimately, their case to the consumer is one that's built and dependent on a degree of trust that I don't think is part of the equation with the telcos.
You know, it's interesting. Looking back at the old AT&T propaganda films and their commercials, their monopoly status was really what and they're really touting their cooperation with the government was exactly what made them so suspect in popular culture back in the day. How have the Googles and Facebooks really managed on some level to avoid this?
Well, so far they have, you know, because, you know, they started out as these scrappy newcomers. I don't think it's in anyone's memory, even in your grandparents' memory, when AT&T might have been a scrappy newcomer there. Even the oldest among us was brought up in an era of Ma Bell. And, you know, and now people are faced with companies like AT&T and Verizon and the other big telecom that, you know, aren't single monopolies, but part of a duopoly of very few companies which handle all our phone calls, both, you know, landline and wireless. And to this day, they have a very deep relationship with the government, and government regulation is really, you know, at the top of their priority list. Customer service, as anyone can tell you, is somewhere behind. And, you know, when they, you know, move off the ball and, you know, can give you some sort of concession saying, you know, well, you can get out of this contract that you must have there, it's usually because someone else is it demanding it, or, you know, one of their, you know, junior partners like T-Mobile comes out and, you know, throws a challenge and saying, we're going to liberate you from this. Whereas on the other hand, a company like Facebook really tries to lure us into the comfort of sharing things we wouldn't do otherwise there. And if we don't trust them, if we feel that it's going directly into the hands of a spy agency, we might be less eager to do our sharing and share and store our information in their cloud and, you know, in the clouds of other places. And that's a big threat to them.
Do you think 2014 has really inaugurated a really significant tension here, where the government seems to want to go back to the old days of the AT&T of the 1950s, post-World War II, and these internet companies are really pushing for something fundamentally different in opposition to the government? And how close did they come to really being swallowed up by this old 1950s mentality?
Well, I think in a way you understate it by putting in the 1950s. The 1950s, you know, we had our phone calls. But even so, if some of us, you know, can vaguely remember, I do, when your dad would travel and make a long distance call, a lot of times he wouldn't even make the call. He would just, you know, put in place a collect call that you'd refuse to let him know he was there. We didn't even use our phones so much. But now, not only are voice calls virtually free, but we share so many more things. In our era here in the 21st century, it's not just phone calls, it's everything. And the government, it finds this irresistible. You know, it's inevitable that the government would want to make use of these communications, whether it's phone or whether it's sharing on Facebook or your selfie or, you know, the data you store in a cloud-based storage company. They want to be able to use that information, they say, when it's necessary. But as we've learned, sometimes, you know, it's shocking to hear the scope of what they collect.
And I guess the question really is, do the companies understand how new this dynamic is, that we're not simply talking about individual conversations, we're talking about data that's, you know, three and four dimensions rich in terms of what it tells us?
Right. And that's, you know, to specify, that's in the phone company, that they go on these, you know, hops from, you know, who you call and who they call, et cetera. And I think they understand that. And I think that's why at this point now, even the telcos realize that they have a perception problem and they're trying to be a little more open. The first time the telcos are going to deliver what they call transparency reports. The internet companies, on the other hand, they really know this. They really know that, you know, it's a threat to them, particularly on their many, many overseas customers who feel, why should I share something, you know, with you folks when the United States government's listening into me, a foreign government?
Is there a possibility of sort of characterizing this in a sort of tortoise versus the hare, or, you know, some kind of a road race? I mean, are the companies ahead of the government in terms of maintaining and establishing privacy as an ethic or as a brand? And is the government going to catch up, inevitably will catch up, that there's no way that this trust can be maintained in the 21st century?
Well, the Snowden thing was a big reset there. And the companies learned that the government was far ahead of them in harvesting their information there. We first heard about this plan called PRISM, where the government, you know, was able to ask them for a lot of information and force them to provide information. But then we learned about this thing called Muscular, where, you know, the government was basically tunneling into data traffic, you know, that went between the data centers of companies like Google and Yahoo. And they said it was legal because they did this overseas. But of course, all kinds of information about Americans, you know, travels through the data center networks there. And then there's a question of, you know, what right does the U.S. have to get all of Google's information on foreign customers there? And that woke the companies up. And then they said, we have to step up our security. And the one striking thing that I found in doing this story was how much the security people at these companies now consider the United States government their main adversary.
You wrote a book called, in 2001, Crypto, How the Code Rebels Beat the Government, Saving Privacy in the Digital Age. Sounds like that's at least worth an update. And if we're in OT here, has the government pulled off a field goal in the final moments?
I think a field goal is maybe a good way to put it there. One thing that we have found, and looking into this, that even though, you know, the NSA is very good at cracking codes, they can't beat all cryptography and all encryption there. You know, if encryption is done right, it really puts a huge roadblock to especially collection of mass data if it's all encrypted there. And maybe that's a good balance to force the government to, you know, have to spend a lot of computation and energy to just to crack the targets rather than to quickly unlock with some sort of master key a whole lot of information there. So I think maybe I have to tweak that subtitle, but the general sentiment still holds.
Stephen Levy is a senior staff writer for Wired. His latest piece is called How the NSA Almost Killed the Internet. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So we've asked you this on many occasions, and there's no way scientifically to really take the pulse of Americans on their trust of technology. Certainly the success of the tech giants suggests that someone trusts them.
This is Tasha from Green Acres, Florida. I have not changed my online habits at all. I never really had any privacy concerns in the first place because I've never done anything I wasn't supposed to do, and I certainly don't have any privacy concerns now.
But a few skeptics now from Memphis, Tennessee. I don't trust Facebook is private. I think they can use it to see us. We are living in the Matrix era.
Hey, this is Eric Mintz from Dallas, Texas. Learning that Big Brother is lying to me is about as surprising as finding out that children sometimes cheat on exams. If and when my online world clashes with my real one, then I will deal with it through the necessary legal channels.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and be part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway, if you dare. Speaking of trust, you get on a plane, you're taking a leap of faith, right? You're trusting aviation technology. Settle into your miniaturized airline seat. You've already shoved your luggage into the miniaturized overhead bin. Now, who did they seat you next to? Who's this guy?
I have a daughter and a son, both married.
Nice to know you. Ken? Ken Balky, is it? In 14A, window seat. He's another kind of tech guy.
Whether it's providing rules for designing nuclear components or providing rules for inspecting the components.
Great, Ken. How long is this flight?
We're providing rules for testing those components.
But Ken is a nuclear engineer at Westinghouse and a senior vice president of ASME Standards, where his work focuses largely on nuclear power, making it safe. Whatever you think about nuclear power, it's people like Ken, who we all have to trust. Have to.
I take my job very seriously, and everyone, not just the nuclear, but any other industries as well, everybody that is involved in standards writing is extremely committed to always doing the right thing and coming up with the right solution for the protection and health and safety of the public.
We continue this week our series of conversations with the behind-the-scenes people who come up with the standards, who make things fit, who make things safe and compatible around the world. Meeting the Standard is about exploring the work that engineers do in their own words. Hey, you can't choose who you sit next to on the airplane, right? Meeting the Standard all this week and later this hour coming up here in The Takeaway. Listen carefully now. Are these guys talking about helping the poor or protecting the rich?
What our nation needs is a real agenda that helps people acquire the skills they need to lift themselves out of poverty and to pursue the American dream.
Everybody cares that we get people out of poverty, but unfortunately, a lot of these strategies have failed miserably to the point where we had the highest poverty rates in a generation.
When two Republican voices with White House ambition, Senator Marco Rubio and Congressman Paul Ryan, make anti-poverty programs the focus of their economic policies, are we seeing the cavalry in the war on poverty declared 50 years ago today by Democratic President Lyndon Johnson?
This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America. And I urge this Congress and all Americans to join with me in that effort.
You've heard that soundbite a lot this week. We thought we would look past the war on poverty today and inquire about what the current Democratic president has called the defining issue of our times, income inequality. What would it take to declare war on the record income inequality in the United States? probably something more than the training programs called for by Senator Rubio. Would it call for a radical critique of free market capitalism, though, that Pope Francis has actually called for publicly? We spoke with Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to the United Nations Secretary General and a consultant to Pope Francis.
We have to address the things that have gone seriously wrong over the last 30 years. At the top of the income distribution, there have been really reckless policies of tax benefits for the super rich. And of course, at the bottom, the bottom has fallen through. Real incomes at the bottom end of the U.S. income distribution have suffered grievously with high unemployment, with a changing labor market, with people who lack the skills and lack the social support to be able to find their way in a changing economy. And all of those require a fresh look after basically 30 years of neglect.
Thinking about Lyndon Johnson and the 50-year anniversary of the war on poverty, now Johnson probably understood he wasn't going to eliminate poverty with his war on poverty, but the notion of indifference to poor people in the United States, he did manage to address, and there were serious resources put towards helping people and creating a safety net. You've talked about the globalization of indifference in dealing with income inequality and Pope Francis's critique of capitalism. How do you address that? You've laid out the case for global inequality, but how do you actually create a war, an offensive, against this indifference in the way that Johnson did 50 years ago?
I think there are two things to note. First, there is a widespread concern, but it has been politics driven by the very top of the income distribution that has held back a lot of the steps that we need. Actually, the American people, looking across the whole spectrum, have supported higher taxes on the rich for a long time, but they don't get their way because their influence in the political process is absolutely tiny. I think the second thing that is crucial is to have a program that is specific ideas that people can believe in and can trust. Now, you look back at LBJ's war on poverty, it has gone down as, quote, a failure. But actually, that's not the case. What happened is that poverty fell very, very sharply during the 1960s from about 22% national poverty rate in 1959 to about 12% a decade later. But by then, two things had happened. One is that the Vietnam War started to eat up the budget that should have continued in that fight against poverty. And the second is the political pendulum swung towards the conservative viewpoint. So it wasn't that the policies were failing. Actually, they were achieving dramatic progress in reducing poverty of the elderly through Medicare, in addressing many, many other challenges. But the political support was lost, and as often happens, war grabbed the resources, the scarce resources of our budget, and the war on poverty became a piece of history rather than an ongoing proposition. So I would say that we need two things. We need the politics responsive to the people rather than just to the top, and that will require a new kind of politics.
Is it a new kind of politics that involves, you know, pitchforks and guns in the Occupy movement, or is there some incentivized way of making this happen? I don't see a gradualism here. What I do see is some sort of unsustainable breakpoint.
Well, I think the Occupy movement's very interesting. It was a new kind of politics, but certainly not a politics of pitchforks and guns. It was peaceful protests in public parks across the country. It attracted massive public support, so much so that these protesters were shoved out of the parks when it became inconvenient. But I think the Occupy movement actually was a fully peaceful way to bring to the public's attention some of the grim realities of our society. And when one turns to the substantive ways to proceed, there again, I believe that there are very big challenges because the labor market definitely has shifted against lower skilled workers big time. This means that new skills, new training, adjusting to the information technology world really requires a change in the way we teach, train, prepare young people for the labor force. But other things are much simpler. We could collect taxes and close down these egregious tax havens in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda and having our IRS let our biggest companies evade what they ought to be paying for the benefit of the American people. Those steps, at least administratively, are rather straightforward, even though politically they're difficult because they mean battling powerful interests.
Well, to watch where a mass movement might emerge, the takeaway might be, do we wait for the pendulum to swing, or will that mass movement be led by someone on the order of Johnson? We'll just have to see. But Jeffrey Sachs, thanks so much.
Good to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Jeffrey Sachs is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to the United Nations Secretary General. We'll be talking about the importance of learning to code later this hour to better understand and use technology. But now, can anyone decode this 21st century diplomacy?
People around the world, I'm going to do one thing. Your guy behind the mic right now, we are the guys here doing one thing. We have to go back to America and take the abuse.
That's former NBA star Dennis Rodman ranting to CNN's Chris Cuomo from Pyongyang, North Korea, yesterday. Today, in honor of Kim Jong-un's birthday, Rodman has assembled a 12-member team to play a demonstration game in North Korea. He says he expects to get abuse for doing this when he gets back home to the U.S., but can he actually accomplish anything in North Korea? Does Dennis Rodman even want to? We're joined by William C. Roden, sports columnist for our partner, The New York Times. Bill, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi there, John. How are things going?
You know, Rodman, I mean, I was a fan of the Bulls. Rodman was great at loose balls and rebounds. I mean, this would be the biggest loose ball and rebound if he can bring Kim Jong-un in from the cold and get Kenneth Bay, the U.S. detainee being held in North Korea, released, right?
If he can get a detainee and a hostage released, then that's sort of the bottom line, no matter how bizarre the technique is. And clearly this would be something that would be a great embarrassment to the U.S. diplomatic corps. And you've got to think that North Korea knows that. They know how embarrassing it already is that Rodman's getting access and an entree and privilege that our diplomatic corps has not even been able to sniff at. So at one level, this is far, far, far beyond basketball.
I mean, Rodman doesn't care if he's being used, right? And he's just interested in attention anywhere he can get it. I mean, it's not like one of his tattoos says Pyongyang or Dear Leader on it, right?
Right. And Rodman is a very shrewd person. Rodman knows exactly what he's doing. And he's been at this for decades. I mean, I think he was one of the first athletes I can remember who really got hip to the whole idea that the American public or the public in general is fascinated by bizarre stuff. I remember he was in New York to play a game. This was with the Bulls. It must have been, I don't know, 20 years ago. But I remember he was doing something that at the time I misread it sort of as like sort of the 60s kind of thing where athletes did things, you know, for political reasons. So you would ask them, why are you doing this? And then they make a statement, you know, that, well, I'm doing this because of poverty or civil rights, or, you know. But I remember I talked to Rodman, and I asked him something, and he just kind of looked at me like I was under the planet, and it became clear to me that there was no rhyme or reason to what he was doing except to have me and media ask him questions or become fascinated by it. And I think that this is clearly taken to another level. I don't think there's anything political about it. I don't think there's anything deeply philosophical about it. It's that this is what was sort of local and national in the 80s is now global.
You know, your colleagues have written very well about the interest the U.S. government has in encryption technology. You've described Rodman as a kind of an encrypted, incomprehensible character. Any chance he's working for the CIA?
Listen, I have no idea, and we all could be working for the CIA. Anything is possible. If we were to find that out in 2 years from now, would anybody really be stunned in this homeland mentality that we're in and scandal? I mean, anything is possible.
Well, in the modern history of North Korea, the U.S. mediators have gone from Jimmy Carter to Bill Richardson to Dennis Rodman. What's next? I guess we all have to ask. Bill Roden, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
William C. Roden is sports columnist for our partner, The New York Times. Airline pilots share the cockpit with the co-pilot. Soon they will have to share their commercial airspace with no-pilot drones. How's that going to work? A few trust issues there, maybe, for pilots, for all of us, right? Last month, the FAA announced that it was granting permission in 10 states to begin civilian drone aircraft testing. The mission? To develop drone safety standards, design pilot training, certification, and everything to safely allow the integration of drones into the nation's airspace, as Congress has authorized by 2015. One of the sites where testing will take place is Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia, working in cooperation with Rutgers University in New Jersey. John Green is overseeing the testing for Virginia Tech and Rutgers, and he says the drones are coming.
We need to crawl before we walk, before we run. The first thing that we do when we start testing aircraft is not to put them into the vicinity of a civilian airport, for example. We're going to test them in remote areas where there's minimal likelihood of interaction with aircraft, and that we'll monitor the environment closely to make sure that whatever we're doing is safe. And then as we gain more confidence in the systems, we'll be able to move into those areas. And I think that gradual process will allow pilots to become more and more confident. You know, one of the things a lot of people don't recognize is that civilian aircraft spend a lot of their time being flown autonomously, with the pilots monitoring what a computer is doing. So what we're talking about is applying that sort of technology in a manner where there may not be a pilot in the aircraft sometimes. And that's a big change, but the whole idea of this process is to allow us to evolve to the point where the level of safety that we provide with unmanned aircraft is equal to or better than what you get with manned aircraft.
Now, everybody who's listening to this who flies commercial will probably be asking the question, yeah, but how do you convey what the stakes are to someone who's sitting in a nice, well-designed ergonomic chair staring at a screen?
Well, that's a really good question, but I think the answer is that has to be driven into the thought process from day one. A culture of safety has to be the foundation for everything that we do, and that's certainly our intent at Virginia Tech, and I know that's the FAA's intent.
What kinds of drone applications in the commercial space do we most want to see developed? Amazon and Jeff Bezos delivering books, et cetera, notwithstanding.
Well, for the short term, we see tremendous opportunities in the field of agriculture, for one. We see the potential to use these tools to provide greater crop yields and minimize the amount of chemicals that are used. And therefore, you get a healthier product, and you cost less because you're applying less chemicals. So we see this as a real opportunity for a three-way win. Another area that I think is ripe for the picking is the area of search and rescue. And what I always say is that, you know, I wouldn't be thrilled with the idea of unmanned aircraft flying over my house all the time at the moment. But if we were going to use those aircraft to find a child that was lost in the woods, then, you know, the risk calculus becomes significantly different. And we think that there are great opportunities to apply unmanned aircraft in the short term for that application.
Does this mean sometime in the future, am I going to have to worry about my commercial jet having to wait 10 more minutes because some drones need to take off?
My goal is that what we'd be doing is that you would be taking off early because the unmanned aircraft system will be more dependable than the pilots that's operating your manned system. So, you know, I foresee that the efficiencies that we can get out of this are probably going to be staggering. Because what we do know is that the vast majority of aircraft accidents that occur as a result of personnel error. So if we can take that out of the equation, we have the potential to make aircraft flight in the United States even safer than it already is. And I have to tell you that we have the safest airspace in the world today because of what the FAA does.
And reducing my time on the tarmac. John Green, I'm going to hold you to that.
You can count on me.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
John Green is the interim executive director of the Mid-Atlantic Aviation Partnership, overseeing one of the sites chosen to test unmanned aircraft in civilian airspace. If you thought the old Monopoly phone company had a problem with public trust issues, what about these guys?
You lied to me last night. We're not going to leave here until you tell us what happened at the plant.
So some anti-nuclear nut tells you that we almost uncovered the core, but we didn't uncover it, did we? We stopped it in time for one simple reason. And I told you that. The system works.
Behold the power plant of the future today!
No, too cold and sterile. Where's the heart?
But it really generates power. It's lighting this room right now.
You lose. Get off my property.
From the China Syndrome to the Simpsons' Mr. Burns, with a dose of Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Fukushima reality thrown in for good measure, trust is a big reason why there hasn't been a nuclear plant come online in the United States since 1996. But we have to trust the existing 104 reactors in the U.S. are safe, right? And someone has to figure that out. Our second conversation on meeting the standards, we hear from Ken Balke, a consulting engineer at Westinghouse and senior vice president of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, ASME Standards, where his work focuses largely on standards for nuclear power.
The main standards for the nuclear industry is that it's still a power plant. It's just that instead of firing the plant with coal or oil or gas, you're firing it with nuclear fission. I very much trust the requirements that we put in place for the selection of materials, the design and operation of our nuclear power plants. If you look over our history, as well as the history of the other pressure technologies, the accident rate of actually having a pressure vessel failure, I'm talking about catastrophic rupture of a vessel or rupture of a pipe, is an extremely rare event. In fact, I'm not aware of any in the nuclear industry, and if they have occurred, they're very, very rare. Because when you look at the standards, the way we put them together, we bring experts from the suppliers, the designers, the manufacturers, the regulators, the insurance companies, and then there's individual consultants and many other parties that comprise a standards writing group. And everyone comes to those meetings, and they're there as engineers trying to say, what is the best practice and requirements we can put in place that we all must meet to give the highest level of assurance that these components will maintain their integrity and will act appropriately if called upon during an event. So it's a fairly, I can't think of a more rigorous process to help assure that safety is maintained.
Although in the three big events in the nuclear industry that have happened where a plant broke down, you've got three very different kinds of events. You've got Three Mile Island, which was a failure of a backup system. You've got Chernobyl, which was just a profoundly flawed engineering concept from the beginning that got completely out of hand. And then you've got Fukushima, which is a situation that was completely overwhelmed by a perhaps unpredictable natural event. I mean, you really have to have your backside covered to write standards that's going to deal with all of that, Ken.
Well, that's what keeps the job interesting. And every time we have a significant event like that, we obviously take a couple steps back. But usually there's a great leap forward in terms of safety. We're still in the midst of the outcome from Fukushima. But let me go back to Three Mile Island, because I was a young engineer at Westinghouse. I remember the day when the event first appeared. And I can tell you that the safety improvements that the U.S. nuclear industry made that were also then shared throughout the globe were enormous steps. Once we realized how the event unfolded, we went back and looked at what did we have to do in our standards to make them safer. And if you look at the operating history of the U.S. reactor fleet, the number of precursor events has greatly diminished because of all the improvements we made after Three Mile Island. If we come forward now to Fukushima, we're in the midst of still learning all the findings from the event. The industry has already taken some very positive steps through its own programs. And from a standards standpoint, we have a standard on probabilistic risk assessment. And our team are currently going back to look at how to address rare yet credible external events. We had Fukushima, which, of course, was the fourth largest earthquake ever to strike the Earth. But near that same time, there was also an historic flood in Missouri. There was also a tornado that struck a plant down in the southeast of the United States. And there was an earthquake that struck a plant in Virginia. And each of those events, one has to look at, well, how can we make sure that we have all the right equipment, people, and procedures in place that we can respond to these really rare yet credible events?
You know, the nuclear industry, because of the lack of political will people in Washington and some of the not in my backyard kinds of attitudes in individual communities that are perhaps understandable because of a fear of nuclear contamination, have postponed the development of standards and of engineering solutions to things like nuclear waste disposal and decommissioning of plants, these sorts of things. Now, I know this isn't your expertise per se, but do you think that in the nuclear industry that politics has really made it a much harder job for engineers to do the work that they need to do to keep things safe?
It's interesting you say that, because if I go back to 100 years ago when the ASME Boiler and Pressure Vessel Code came about, there were politics at that time. So my own personal reaction is the politics are what they are. And as engineers, we're more concerned about making sure that we do have the standards in place to address the safety needs of the public, whether it be a nuclear power plant or gas pipeline or any other high-hazard application. In terms of the nuclear waste, ASME does write the standards for the storage and transport of nuclear waste.
And are they paying attention to you? And is any of that ever going to happen? Because it's sitting in pools right now. That must make you crazy.
There's things I can control and there's things I cannot control.
There we go.
And the things I can control is if the nuclear plant owners or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission ask for help in having a standard put in place, whether it's for storing nuclear waste or dealing with rare external events, you know, we step up and we bring the best talent, not just from the United States. We have people on our standards in the nuclear area from more than 40 countries who help us in writing standards to assure safety of the public, not only here in the United States, but around the globe.
Kenneth Balke is a consulting engineer at Westinghouse and senior vice president of ASME Standards and Certifications. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We'll leave you with this techno-linguistic question this hour. So what's your first language? Is it English? Spanish? Is it Chinese? Is it Arabic? Is it C? C++? Java? Python? Assembly? Manush Zomorodi, host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City. What was your first language?
It was actually two, English and German.
All right, but that's the terrestrial languages. What about programming language?
I would say the VCR. I was able to program the VCR.
Does that count? Allie Blackwell, does that count?
I think the VCR counts as a programming environment.
Allie Blackwell, co-founder of the programming training workshops run by the company Decoded. Your first language?
JavaScript.
JavaScript, that is, of course, a programming language. I'm wondering, Ali, and welcome to both of you, by the way.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Can we envision the time when a generation will learn a programming language either at the same time or before they learn a linguistic language. Is that within reach at this point, Ali?
I think it will come very soon after learning a normal language like English. I think they need to start learning the principles of programming at about six and carry on throughout education.
Now, you actually had this experience yourself. I mean, you decided to graduate from VCR assembly language to something more maybe practical, and you took one of Alistair Blackwell's courses.
I did. So as you mentioned, I host a tech show, and I have to say, John, I'm just embarrassed at how little I really felt that I understood the workings of the laptops, the phones, everything that's running our digital life these days.
One of your listeners outed you. Come on. Right.
Every day, my friend. So I signed up. I was like, look, I don't have time. I have two little kids. I run a show. Let me go take this class called Code in a Day, run by this British company, Decoded, that is – Ali runs it.
Right.
And they're starting to do more classes in New York. So I signed up for a day. And, you know, to be honest, my goal was just to sort of confront my fears of I can't do this is what I sort of thought. And, you know, Ali, I give him a ton of credit because he's I think you described yourself as a failed actor turned coder. And, and you know, they spoke a normal language to someone like me who doesn't come naturally to.
Well, here's somebody who also gave the would-be coders of the world a bit of a pep talk. You may recognize the voice of President Barack Obama.
Don't just buy a new video game. Make one. Don't just download the latest app. Help design it. Don't just play on your phone. Program it. No one's born a computer scientist, but with a little hard work and some math and science, just about anyone can become one.
Ali Blackwell, little hard work, little math and science, you can become a computer scientist. Is that realistic?
It is absolutely realistic.
Oh, Ali, I don't know. I don't know. Go ahead.
Okay, I think there's two sides to this. For young people just starting out in school, it takes a lot of time, but they've got the time to do that, and I think they're going to have that opportunity within school. For adults who didn't do it at school, we don't all need to be programmers. That's the truth. Manoush, you run a show. You don't need to know how to code, but you need to have an understanding of it, and that's what our workshops provide. It's for the people who aren't ever realistically going to do a complete career change and become software developers. It's for people who just need to have that understanding, that broad understanding of technology.
Now, Manoush, you've alluded to the challenge here that you've experienced personally. I took Fortran in college, a business language, COBOL, also a business language, then learned more recursive sort of AI languages like Pascal. All obsolete today, completely, absolutely. A lot of people know HTML if they have their own website,
yep.
But the languages for building apps like Java and Python,
yep.
Making video games, those things are much more challenging. Where do you think the innovation tipping point is going to come if a sizable portion of the population actually does know how to code in the way that Ali is suggesting may happen?
I think that there's going to have to be a revamping of K-12 education and the way that we teach our kids' brains to function. I have to tell you, I was not the kid who understood multiplication. I was the kid who memorized the tables and spat it back out. And hopefully what we're seeing is that teachers are understanding that different brains work differently. There are different learning styles, and we have to break things down and explain to them how these things work, not just here it is, you know it for the test, and that's it. And I'm starting to see this with my own kids.
Languages, though, computer languages have also become much more intuitive. I mean, Fortran was an impossible language to figure out. It was very mathematical, but by the time you get to, you know, something like C++, it's much more intuitive. How far do we have to go to get it even more like the languages we speak today? Ali?
I think it will probably never get to the point where you can just say, computer, build me an app that tracks a user's location, and it will just be done. I think that probably won't happen. But the languages do get more intuitive, and there's less brackets and braces. So they do get more intuitive. But I doubt we'll ever be able to just sort of speak and it be programmed.
Do you think that a tipping point is out there, that innovation will be driven by fluency in computer programming, or is it, you know, something else, fundamentally different?
I really think it is that understanding of the possibilities of technology. Now, that, I mean, we see that as an understanding of the code that underpins technology, that if you have that understanding, you are aware of the possibilities. And as more and more people wake up to the possibilities, that the rise of the web, the rise of big data, gives us as a human species. As more and more people see that, then more and more innovation will happen.
Did digital natives and their linguistic knowledge, do you think that's converging with some of the difficulties of computer programming languages in the sense that we may have to revamp education, but kids are getting there on their own because they're learning,
you know,
they're much better at VCRs than you were?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's an example from my own life that I think of that would never happen today. In 10th grade, I was sat down by the department, the head of the math department, and told that I did not have a natural aptitude for math. And that maybe I should take the other track and not do calculus. In today's...
That person is in jail today?
I don't know. Right? And whatever, however long ago that was, a long time ago, I will say, 25 years ago, we're gasping at that. People don't talk like that anymore as like, you don't have the aptitude. I think there's an acceptance that some of us are really awesome at some stuff and some of us are really not, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't give it a go.
So actor, coder, a final thought there, Allie?
I think education needs to fundamentally change. Attitudes amongst teachers need to change. It's not about broadcasting knowledge from the front. It's about learning alongside your students. And I think this will happen first in computer science and then in other subjects as well. So you will never have that idea again. Everyone learns in different ways. There's so much to learn. And also education mustn't stop at 18 or 21.
And you've got acting as a backup, right? To fall back on if the coding thing doesn't work out. Allie Blackwell is one of the co-founders of Decoded, which runs workshops to teach anyone to code. He's also Manoush Zamarodi's coding instructor. Manoush Zamarodi, host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Allie, and thank you, John.
Thanks, John. Great to see you, Manoush. Bye.
So throughout today's show, we've been discussing technology, the internet, and you. We want to know, has your relationship to technology changed since the NSA Edward Snowden revelations? What technology do you trust and not trust?
Post-NSA, I use no social media, and I'm very careful about what websites I go to. I trust no technology that is connected to the internet.
That's Bill from Olympia, Washington, and just down the road on I-5 from Portland, Oregon. My relationship with internet and technology hasn't changed at all since the NSA revelations. Part of me feels like if you have nothing to hide, why be worried about who is monitoring your activity online? I feel like the government getting involved with our activity online is inevitable. I feel like it may even be beneficial in helping our country to become a safer place. Tell us what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE. If you're willing to use the internet, visit us at thetakeaway.org. Someone will be watching, hopefully on our staff. While you're there, you can hear all the interviews in our Meeting the Standard series and see a photo slideshow of our friend John Green and his team working on the unmanned drone aircraft in commercial space. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.